Senate Committee on Commerce. Today is Friday, March 9, 2007, Harris Hall. The chair is Senator Floyd Przanski.
Good afternoon. I think that sounds a little loud. Is that? So we'll try to get that down. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Commerce to order. And first of all, I'd like to go through a couple of procedures that we have today. First is the thank yous. I'm not sure if hopefully Dave Factor's here or not. I want to thank the Lane County Courts and the Lane County Commissioners for allowing us to use Harris Hall today for our meeting. Today we will be taking a public hearing and testimony on Senate Bill 583. And 583 is a bill that you'll hear a little bit more information regarding that deals with identity theft. And we will be having presentations first from invited testimony, which will be from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And then we have individuals that were part of our work group that helped put this bill together. And then we'll be hearing from the Judicial Department, and then we'll be here taking in testimony from various individuals. I want to thank everyone for being here this afternoon. And if you, let's say, if you need to use the restroom facilities, my understanding is there are some downstairs out these two little side wooden doors, or you can go through the glass doors over here on the, what it would be my right-hand side, and there's a set that's right outside and back to the right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and ask Ms. Braun if you will go ahead and give us an overview of what the bill does, and then we'll call up our first panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 583 enacts the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act. Provisions include notifications to consumers in the most expedient time possible and without unreasonable delay for breach of security of computerized data, allows consumers to place a security freeze on their consumer report to block access to their credit for $10 or for free if they are a victim of identity theft, allows consumers to have the ability to temporarily lift the freeze for $10, prohibits printing or displaying a social security number unless redacted with exceptions, creates a duty for those who maintain or otherwise possess data or own data to safeguard personal information, including using safe disposal methods, authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services to enforce and make rules to regulate the provisions of the bill, including assessing penalties of not more than $1,000 for every violation and $500,000 for any continuing violation, declares an emergency, takes effect October 1st, 2007. There's no revenue impact so far on this bill and may have a fiscal impact, but the statement is not yet issued. We have on our desk several letters, one from the Oregon Credit Union supporting the bill, one from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services supporting the bill, and one from the Software Association raising some concerns. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Anna. Before we take our first panel, I guess I want to finish up some of the thank yous. Since we're not at the Capitol, one of the things I want to make certain that individuals know what we are attempting to do in the legislature is bring a lot of the issues that we deal with into the communities. And we had chosen that this being one that we thought would have a lot of interest for community members and citizens of the state to take on the road. And so this is the second session that we've actually reinstituted where we're having what's known as field hearings. And so I want to thank everyone for being here that as part of the community. I also want to thank and acknowledge the members of the committee for the Senate Commerce. And I think what I'm going to do is just allow each individual to identify themselves so you can see who the members are and what parts of the state that they represent. And so, Senator Monroe, if you'd be so kind.
Thank you very much, Chair Przanski. I'm Rod Monroe, state senator from kind of the eastern part of Portland and northern part of Clackamas County. And my background is that I have been a teacher and a college professor of history and government most all of my life, and I also have served in various elective offices over the last 30 years.
Good afternoon. I am Avelle Gordley. I represent Senate District 23 in Multnomah County. In my other life, I serve as an associate professor in the Department of Black Studies at Portland State University. I am in my 16th year of service in the Oregon legislature, and I still remain amazed at what a privilege it is to serve. And as I said to my two colleagues on the way down this afternoon, I'm still pinching myself about the privilege of being able to serve in our great state.
And Brad Avaki and I represent the easternmost portion of Washington County, which would include the Beaverton, Alloa, and part of the Hillsborough areas, and then over the West Hills down into Multnomah County, where I also represent northwest Portland, and then up along the Willamette River towards Scappoose. And I'm very pleased to be here in Eugene with all of you.
And Senator Roger Beyer is scheduled to be here. We're not sure if he's running into difficulties. As you can imagine, with Senator's schedule, sometimes things happen. So he may be joining us later. And just for those who are not familiar with the district I represent, my district is Senate District 4, includes a good portion of Lane County, all of East Lane County, and South Central Lane County, including portions of Eugene, upriver on the McKenzie River, the Oak Ridge area, Cottage Grove, Lorraine. The district also goes into Douglas County and takes in all of East Douglas County and the north central parts of the East Douglas County. So, again, thank you for being here and being part of our field hearing. And what I'd like to go ahead and do is call up our first panel, which would be the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So, Corey and Lou, I'm not sure if you have anyone else that's joining the two of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be back in my hometown of Eugene. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is Lou Savage, our Senior Policy Advisor. And as Ms. Braun said, the department is given administrative and enforcement responsibilities under this bill. It's a pleasure to be here in support of this bill. As I think you know, strong protections against identity theft have been a priority for Governor Kulongoski, and I know they've been a priority for many members of the legislature as well. Identity theft continues to be a very significant problem across the country and here in Oregon. I believe Oregon ranks 13th highest for identity theft, which is very troubling to us because the consequences of identity theft can be so serious. It can result in damaged credit records, inability to arrange your financial affairs, unauthorized withdrawals from bank accounts, and often the consequences of straightening out the results of identity theft can last for years and years. So the purpose behind Senate Bill 583 is to provide security against identity theft, to significantly reduce the incidence of these crimes, and also to reduce the consequences for consumers if and when an unfortunate incident of a data breach occurs. I know I want to commend Senator Pozanski in particular for your long work on this project. I know that there's been many hours. I've seen you personally chair many hours of committee hearings and participate in many hours of work group meetings, starting last session and well into the interim, to bring together the widely diverse interests that have resulted in this bill. So I think we all owe a vote of thanks to you and to the members of the work group who put this bill together. I would like to turn it over to Lou Savage to go through with you some of the provisions of the bill, and then both of us will be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, as Corey said, I'm Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I helped to coordinate the work group that worked on this Senate Bill 583, for about 7 or 8 months. The work group was comprised of members, representatives from business groups, consumer advocates, law enforcement, and state and local government agencies. There were over 25 active groups members, and we met regularly from middle of June through January. As Corey mentioned, Senator Pozanski was not only active in the group, but he attended every meeting, and I believe that it was due to his leadership that we were successful in reaching a consensus on the major elements of Senate Bill 583. We've actually included, with my testimony, a list of the members of the work group, and you can see it's a very diverse group. And we believe that the major interests and perspectives on identity theft were represented at the table.
Lou, I just want to say I thank you for the kudos, but I just want to make sure you understand I'm not on Ways and Means, so I can't make money. But thank you very much.
Senator, our budget's out of subcommittee. So.
Oh, okay.
As I mentioned, the work group was comprised of a really diverse group of viewpoints, and really the first thing that we decided that we needed to do was to agree upon the goals of the legislation, and that actually was done fairly quickly. We agreed that the legislation needed to provide a level of assurance to consumers that their personal information would be safeguarded, to decrease the incidence of identity theft in a meaningful way, to reduce the damage done to victims of identity theft, to not unduly burden business and to ensure the timely flow of commerce, and to provide for appropriate exceptions where that was really needed for specific agencies or business interests. The bill itself, we believe, contains strong standards for safeguarding personal information. It provides notification to consumers if there is a breach in security that might result in the disclosure of information. It gives consumers the right to request a security freeze of their credit file, so that it provides some protection against the identity theft, particularly when obtaining credit, if the thief attempts to obtain credit in the consumer's name. The bill itself is very detailed, but I thought it would be helpful to provide just a summary of the sections, and certainly we're available to answer any questions, and there's probably no better person in the room to answer specifics than the chair of the committee.
Good testimony technique.
But I'm on this side, you're on that side. So.
The Section 2 of the bill sets out a definition of terms, and one of the most important definitions is the definition of personal information. It's very important to have a definition of personal information because it provides guidance to business as to what information should be protected and when notification is necessary to consumers. Personal information under the definition of the bill can include a combination of an individual's name and key information such as a social security number or driver's license number, which if acquired by an identity thief could result in personal information being used to obtain credit in the thief's name, in the consumer's name, and basically do the sorts of things that would damage a consumer. So that's why the definition of personal information is so important. If a security breach does occur, it's important that the consumer is notified. Section 3 of Senate Bill 583 sets out the requirements for notification to consumers. The notification must be given in the most expedient time possible, consistent with the needs of law enforcement. The work group actually spent a great deal of time discussing the most effective way to provide notice to consumers of a security breach. Section 3 requires written notice in most instances, but allows for electronic notice if that's the primary method of communication between the individual and the business, or telephone notice if the individual is contacted directly. The work group also agreed that at some point the cost of individual notification might just be too high. So Section 3 also specifies that if the number of individuals to be notified is more than 350,000 or the cost for notification is over $250,000, that a business may notify through the major television and newspaper media. But the method of doing that is also specified in the bill. A consumer can suffer serious economic damage if an identity thief uses personal information to apply for credit in the consumer's name. Section 4 gives the consumer, any Oregonian, the right to request a security freeze on his or her consumer report. This was an issue that was, again, discussed a great deal in the work group, and the consensus was that this is a tool that should be available for all Oregonians. It's important that if a security freeze is requested,
that this be accomplished as soon as possible. Section 5 of the bill requires a consumer reporting agency to place a freeze no later than 5 business days after receiving the request from a consumer. There may be circumstances, even when a freeze is in effect, that a consumer needs to apply for credit. So there is also a provision that the consumer may temporarily lift the freeze and requires the consumer reporting agency to temporarily lift the freeze within 3 days after receiving that request from the consumer. There was a great deal of discussion as to how long the credit reporting agency should have to both put the freeze on and to respond to a temporary lift. There are a couple of other states that have a shorter time provision. Those provisions in those other states do not take effect for at least a couple of years. So the compromise that we reached in the work group was that the Department of Consumer and Business Services will be required to report back to the legislature as to the state of the technology. So the legislature will have the opportunity to review whether the time periods set out in this bill are short enough. The freeze is available to all consumers. The agreement of the work group was that if the consumer is actually a victim of identity theft, the freeze should be available without any charge. So that is in Section 6 of the bill. If a consumer is not a victim of identity theft, the consumer reporting agency may charge a reasonable fee of not more than $10 to place a security freeze and to temporarily lift a freeze or to permanently remove the freeze. And again, this was a product of compromise. We wanted to give all consumers the ability to have the freeze, but in terms of the ability to have it without a charge, this bill limits that to victims of identity theft. And that includes an individual who has made a police report that would have a police report that they could provide to the credit reporting agency. Section 7 of the bill prohibits the consumer reporting agency from temporarily lifting or permanently removing the freeze unless it was requested by the consumer or unless it was frozen because of a misrepresentation by a consumer.
Mr. Chair, would you like to wait till the end for questions? Or?
No, I think it would probably be better to take questions.
Let me ask one now.
That's right.
Right. This notion of needing the police report before you can get the freeze, was there any discussion about how long it takes to get a police report so that you can get that in a timely manner to the credit agency? And then second, do you know whether or not the length of time it takes depends upon what jurisdiction you're in?
Chair Przanski, Senator Vaki, and there was discussion about that, and I was probably not as precise as I should have been on the report itself, because the discussion revolved around the very question that you asked, and it seemed to be the consensus that the kind of report that was necessary for the credit reporting agency to act on the request for a freeze was something that was not particularly difficult to obtain. I know that Jim Marquis will be up at the panel soon, and he could probably clarify that as well. If I can put my finger on the exact section of the bill, I will do that. Yes, it's actually a valid police report, incident report, or identity theft declaration. So an incident report actually, from my understanding from law enforcement, is a much easier document to obtain.
And Senator Avakian, when we had the work group meeting, we did discuss this, as Mr. Savage has said, and clearly what we're wanting to do is make sure it's as easy as possible. The incident report can be basically done over the phone, where they can get a number, something they can report back. And then the declaration, from my understanding, from the Department of Justice, is where that would be filed, is online. So we think that it can be done relatively quick.
And I understand, Mr. Chair, that an incident report is something that is used probably in every law enforcement jurisdiction in the state, so that everybody would have equal access to the same type of process.
Yeah, Chair Przewalski, Senator Ivaki, and I believe that's the case.
Section 8 of Senate Bill 583 allows access to a consumer report for specified law enforcement and business purposes. Again, this was a discussion that occurred in the work group to provide for those instances where, for example, a court order is appropriate and the information in the consumer report is necessary to ensure the justice system is actually able to work. Section 9 of the bill allows for a credit application to be treated as incomplete if a security freeze is in effect and the consumer does not allow access to the file as part of an application for credit. And this was a provision that businesses asked to be put in because they didn't want to be caught in the double bind of the consumer having frozen their file, asking for credit, but they can't access the file itself to be able to make a determination as to whether the consumer is creditworthy. Section 10 of the bill prohibits a consumer reporting agency from changing a consumer's name, date of birth, social security number, or address in the report if a security freeze is in place, unless written confirmation of the change is sent within 30 days of the change to the consumer. And again, this is an additional consumer protection so that those critical pieces of information can only be changed by the consumer themselves. Section 11 of the bill addresses the issue of social security numbers. It prohibits the public display or disclosure of more than the last four digits of a social security number. It does create an exception for records that are required by law to be made available to the public. There was a fair amount of discussion about the existing law, and we wanted to make sure that in those instances the exception was there. One of the most important sections of the bill is Section 12. Consumers really should have confidence that their personal information will be safeguarded. And Section 12 requires that businesses and organizations that possess and collect personal data have reasonable safeguards to protect a consumer's personal information. Section 12 provides guidelines for businesses that would meet the standards for safeguarding personal information. It's important to know that these are guidelines. There's a fairly long list of guidelines, but these are in fact guidelines, not requirements. If a business or organization implements a safeguarding program that includes the appropriate measures listed in the guidelines, they will have deemed to have been in compliance with the safeguarding requirements. So this provides a roadmap for businesses and organizations as to what they can do to safeguard the information. But again, it's not a requirement. They can look at those guidelines and say, well, if I put these in place in a way that's appropriate for my business, then I'm going to be pretty safe that that I've complied with the Act. There's also provision that would say that businesses and organizations that comply with state and federal laws requiring safeguarding that would meet the requirements for the safeguarding provision of the bill. And this would specifically include organizations and businesses that are subject to the Gramm-Leach-Bliley and HIPAA federal acts. Section 12 also recognizes that safeguarding measures must fit individual circumstances. And there's a specific provision in Section 12 that addresses small businesses, so that the small businesses that look at the safeguarding provisions understand that the measures that they adopt can be appropriate to the size and sensitivity of the information that they are possessing and that they deal with. Section 13 of the Act gives the Department of Consumer and Business Services the authority to enforce the Act using what we consider our traditional agency enforcement tools. And Section 14 of the Act, it gives the agency the authority to adopt administrative rules to implement the Act itself.
In closing, I'd just like to echo Corey's comments, thanking Senator Prozanski for his leadership on the work group and members of the work group themselves for their hard work. It was really a collaborative effort that resulted in a very good product. Finally, a number of individuals have asked us how Senate Bill 583 compares with identity theft protection laws in other states. We've attached to my testimony and Corey's testimony a chart which goes through states. This is the 8.5 by 14 chart that goes through the states that have enacted identity theft laws and breaks it down by the various essential elements of the act. And I think what's noteworthy when you look at this chart is there are states that have adopted various provisions which are in Senate Bill 583, but there are actually very few states that have a comprehensive view of identity theft and really takes the issue and addresses it in a way that connects the various aspects of consumer protection for identity theft. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We do request your support for Senate Bill 583.
Thank you. Questions from the panel? Or on the overview? Not hearing. Thank you very much. Our next invited group will be people who are part of the work group, and so I'm going to go ahead and call up this time Jim Craven, Jim Marquis, Eva Novick, and Laura Etherton. Whoever wants to lead off.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Laura Etherton, and I'm the Consumer Advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. OSPIRG is a public interest advocacy group here in Oregon. According to the Federal Trade Commission, Oregon ranks 13th in the nation for identity theft. Victims spend money, time, trying to clear their good names when identity theft occurs to them. This problem has become so prevalent here in Oregon that practically every one of us has either had identity theft happen to us or we know someone who it's happened to. And it is it's not a fun thing. No one benefits from it other than the identity thief, and so it is very good for us to address this problem here in Oregon. I want to talk a little bit specifically about our analysis of two of the major factors that are contributing to the problem of identity theft, which are critical if we are to prevent this from happening in the first place. Of course, really solving the problem of identity theft takes a number of different approaches, from law enforcement to preventing identity theft from happening in the first place. We know that law enforcement alone, we cannot arrest ourselves out of this problem. It will take preventing the problem from happening in the first place, and that is the aim of this bill. Two significant factors contributing to the rise and the epidemic, really, of identity theft are how easy it is for thieves to get their hands on personal information. The second problem is how easily thieves can use that personal information to open up new accounts in the victim's name. To help prevent identity theft, Oregon must address both of these aspects. So first, talking about preventing thieves from achieving access to personal information. I think consumers are doing a better and better job all the time of protecting their own information, being careful about what information goes out into their garbage and what's coming in through their mail, and people have shredders, and it's a new era. But, of course, whether it's government entities or business entities, a number of different institutions are collecting and sharing and selling information about all of us more than ever before. And so a lot of personal information is not in the hands of the consumer themselves. If these entities fail to keep that information safeguarded, it can fall easily into the hands of identity thieves.
the laptop breach of Providence Home Health Services is just one example that made the headlines in recent years. But this has been part of an overall trend of personal information security breaches affecting hundreds of thousands, even reaching into the millions of people. Recently, in mid-January of this year, TJX companies, which owns stores such as TJ Maxx and Marshalls, experienced a consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. OSPIRG is a public interest advocacy group here in Oregon. According to the Federal Trade Commission, Oregon ranks 13th in the nation for identity theft. Victims spend money, time, trying to clear their good names when identity theft occurs to them. This problem has become so prevalent here in Oregon that practically every one of us has either had identity theft happen to us or we know someone who it's happened to. And it is a, it's not a fun thing. No one benefits from it other than the identity thief, and so it is very good for us to address this problem here in Oregon. I want to talk a little bit specifically about our analysis of two of the major factors that are contributing to the problem of identity theft, which are critical if we are to prevent this from happening in the first place. Of course, really solving the problem of identity theft takes a number of different approaches, from law enforcement to preventing identity theft from happening in the first place. We know that law enforcement alone, we cannot arrest ourselves out of this problem. It will take preventing the problem from happening in the first place, and that is the aim of this bill. Two significant factors contributing to the rise and the epidemic, really, of identity theft are how easy it is for thieves to get their hands on personal information. The second problem is how easily thieves can use that personal information to open up new accounts in the victim's name. To help prevent identity theft, Oregon must address both of these aspects. So first, talking about preventing thieves from achieving access to personal information. I think consumers are doing a better and better job all the time of protecting their own information, being careful about what information goes out into their garbage and what's coming in through their mail, and people have shredders, and it's a new era. But, of course, whether it's government entities or business entities, a number of different institutions are collecting and sharing and selling information about all of us more than ever before. And so a lot of personal information is not in the hands of the consumer themselves. If these entities fail to keep that information safeguarded, it can fall easily into the hands of identity thieves. The laptop breach of Providence Home Health Services is just one example that made the headlines in recent years. But this has been part of an overall trend of personal information security breaches affecting hundreds of thousands, even reaching into the millions of people. Recently, in mid-January of this year, TJX companies, which owns stores such as TJ Maxx and Marshalls, experienced a security breach that affected millions of shoppers, and that's just one more example of this problem. To address the problem, businesses and government should secure people's personal information, should limit the use and display of social security numbers, and very importantly, should notify consumers if their information falls into the wrong hands. And this is critical for a couple of reasons, the breach notification piece. One, it is very important for consumers to quickly know whether or not their information has been compromised so they can be vigilant, they can be on the lookout for new accounts that are being opened into their name, they can keep an eye on their credit card bills, their bank accounts, and can take a look at their credit records as well, their credit reports. But it also serves as a powerful incentive for businesses, for government, for other institutions to keep information secure in the first place. No one wants to send out a security breach notice, and having the requirement there is a powerful incentive to keep the information safe in the first place. At least 30 states now have some type of breach notification on the books, and it's a good idea for Oregon to join their ranks. Senate Bill 583 includes provisions to do all of these pieces, as you've heard, and we think that's an important step forward for Oregonians. Talking briefly about helping to block identity theft from occurring, so even if a thief gets access to personal information, it's very important that protections help to make that information ineffectual, to basically reduce the street value of stolen personal information by giving consumers the ability to make it impossible for thieves to open new accounts in their names. a little bit about how this sort of happens. If an identity thief gets enough information about you, they can open up a new account in your name. And a consumer may, a victim of this type of identity theft, may only find out about this much, much later through looking at their consumer report or getting a call from a collector. That it might be how they find out about this whole new account they've never known about before. It's the most damaging type of identity theft. The Federal Trade Commission estimates that each instance of this type of identity theft can cost as much as, the thief can abscond with about $10,000 or more. So it's a significant piece. To block thieves from opening new accounts, Oregonians should have the right to control access to their consumer report through the use of a security freeze. A security freeze is the right to control access to your consumer report or any information from it by protecting it with a passcode, so similar to an ATM PIN number. And it's a very successful tool, partly because a potential creditor won't issue new credit or a new cell phone account or new car loan, for example, without checking the consumer's consumer report. If only the actual consumer can grant access to that consumer report, it can just block a potential identity thief from being able to open a fraudulent account in that consumer's name. It's a very effective tool, and at least 26 states give consumers in their states the right to place such a freeze. Finally, just want to close Senate Bill 583 includes, of course, a provision to give consumers the right to a security freeze. They'd be able to place it, as you've heard, by paying $10 to each of the three credit reporting agencies to enact that. The freeze provision does, we believe, require a small technical fix, important but small, to ensure that it actually achieves the intention of the bill, to make sure that it not only blocks new credit from being opened, but types of accounts that are sort of like credit, like a cell phone account or a utility account, which are actually problems in terms of identity theft. And it's a small piece, but it's an important one to make sure that Oregonians are protected. With that fix made, the security freeze should be a very powerful tool for Oregonians to protect themselves from identity theft and help to reduce the incidence of this crime. On behalf of Osberg, I wanted to thank Senator Prozanski for your leadership on this issue, and I also wanted to thank all the people who served on the work group and put so much time and care into the discussion. We're looking forward to working together continually toward the common goal of ensuring that these protections actually help to reduce identity theft here in Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. We're a national trade association that represents the high-tech industry. We have members who are both produce electronic hardware, who produce software, and probably pertinent to this bill are electronic consumer companies, internet retailers, internet providers, and the like. I'll cut to the chase as far as the suspense to say that we wholeheartedly support this bill, and we were a member of the work group way back since June, I guess it was, and we do support it. I think there are various people in the work group maybe have a word or two, a sentence or so that might need just a little bit of polishing, but overall, the general architecture of the whole bill we do support, and we were pleased to be a member of the work group. There's a lot of thank yous going on here, but I have to personally thank the chairman for all his efforts in putting up with us for I don't even know how many meetings, but Lou Savage from DCBS, who did a lot of the work, and his staff, Laura Roach, who's over here to my left. A lot of work groups have a chairperson, but we actually had a facilitator, and sort of slapped us around a little bit, kept us in line. But it was the first time I've actually done a long-standing work group that had a professionally trained facilitator, and it was a good experience to have somebody in the room who really had no dog in the fight at all, other than to help us get to yes and help us get to a good work product. And so maybe it's something to think about for future work groups that you all put together to try to get bills done. I think the As Laura Etherton said, we're a little bit late to the game in terms of other states, a year or two. It's not that we're years behind. The various components of this bill have been emerging from the laboratories of democracies in the 50 states. I think there are many of us who believe that this maybe would have been or still might be better served by some uniform rules of engagement. Credit reporting bureaus have data on citizens in all states. Internet sites work with consumers from all states. But we have tried at AEA, because we also have a federal presence, been working in Congress the last few years to try to get to a uniform set of rules at the federal level. We haven't got there. So I think many of us came into the workgroup process with a goal to say, look, a number of states have done bills. Let's profit from their hard work. And in some states, because I see the email traffic, quite frankly, some of the bloodletting that went on in other forum around the states, and we didn't have that kind of process here, and partly because we took the time during the interim to work on this. It was a very collegial process, and there really wasn't a knockdown, drag-out component to it. I think some consumer protection legislation, and you probably know what I'm talking about, there are sides. You know, there's the consumer side versus the business side. But really, in this issue, nobody in the workgroup's the bad. None of us are the bad guys. The bad guys are the people out there trying to steal consumers' credit, trying to steal their bank accounts. And so we're really a group of people, both businesses that are trying to protect our own consumers, because it's important to our consumer relationships. It's important to our reputation not to be on the front page of the Oregonian in repeated fashion. And it's important, to protect people. So really we had a work group composed of people really all trying to do the same thing, which was protect consumers from identity theft. And that made it a little different from some of the battles you get engaged in, where it's more of an us against them kind of thing. My part on the work group was particularly focused on the security breach provisions. And I think among all the laws in the country, this is as good as any, maybe the best. It's not that it's weaker or stronger, it's that maybe it's a little more thoughtful. And again, it's because we took the time, and because a lot of states have already tried this, and we got to look at a lot of other work products and compare them, and so we did benefit from that. I think in closing, it's important to note that this is a small part of a really big problem, and the work you did last session on methamphetamine was work on identity theft, because those in the law enforcement world that I talk to say identity theft could be 80 to 90% driven by the meth epidemic. So part of fighting identity theft was the work you did in 2005 to fight meth use, because it is, what I'm told, a huge driver of this issue. Consumer education is also key, as Laura mentioned. Good business practices is also key. Vigorous law enforcement is also key. So we're taking some steps here in this bill to address some issues. There's a lot bigger part of the picture that we need to continue to work on. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Markey. I represent a variety of clients in the financial sector, which includes Oregon Collectors Association, the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, as well as TransUnion, one of the three credit reporting agencies that will be dealing with the credit freeze after you pass this bill. I want to say that this process has been long and hard. And I think that we have arrived at a pretty good product. I want to take the opportunity to thank three people. I thought about thanking them by their social security numbers instead of their names.
Last four only.
Well, you got till October 1st.
Last four digits.
Yeah, last four digits only. First, Senator Pyrzanski, I just can't say enough about his endurance here. I've been on a lot of work groups over the years with the Oregon legislature, and usually we get a legislator in charge of a work group, and with a busy schedule, oftentimes a staff member is assigned to attend the meetings for them. And I don't remember an 8-month-long task force where the chairman of the Commerce Committee attended every meeting we had and never arrived late and never left early, and was engaged throughout the process, and I just really want to commend you, Senator Brzezinski, for that. It was a new experience for me. And Lou Savage from the Department of Consumer and Business Services brought his special skill set to this project. I don't know anybody else in state government that could have kept the wide variety of people we had at the table together like he did, and he was on the phone to people and solving problems, and we all had a goal in mind, but we all had different ideas about how to get there, and he was great. And Laura, I was hoping to be the first to thank Laura, our facilitator, but she was fantastic and kept us on track and kept us civil when we didn't want to be, and she was great. So I think that everybody involved in this process really wanted to find a way to protect consumer information, that information which is held by the public bodies in the state and by the private sector. And what I like about this bill is that it brings protection for the consumer for information held by both those sectors, and does it in a way that doesn't shut down business. And I think that we were all concerned that, you know, we want to protect consumers, but we want the free flow of enterprise to continue. And I think that we found some pretty good middle ground. This bill is now out of our hands and in your hands. And I would just say that we all worked very, very hard at trying to arrive at compromises in this bill, both in the breach area and in the security freeze area. And Laura's right, there are 26 states that have security freezes now, and I think we picked the best provisions from most of them and found a pretty good middle ground. I think I could find a couple of states that don't contain provisions that ours does, and I could argue about that, and Laura could find some things on the consumer side that some state contains that she wants here, whatever. But we've got a pretty good product. It was a delicate balance to reach. I would urge you to think about that as you move the bill forward and think about those balances. I would hate to see this thing. I think there will be some technical amendments that will be needed along the way, as with anything this complex, you're going to need to look at that. But with respect to those judgments that this work group came to, I would hope that you would respect those and keep them in place. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Eva, why don't we hear from you, and then we'll open up the panel for any other questions.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eva Novick. I am an Assistant Attorney General in the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section of the Oregon Department of Justice. I will try to be brief because I know you'll hear a lot of the same information today. But as many of you are aware, identity theft is one of the fastest growing crimes in the United States and represents the single biggest threat to an individual's financial integrity. Not only is it costly to individuals, it is also costly to businesses. And this underscores the need for Oregonians to be able to take proactive measures to prevent their personal information from being used by identity thieves. Over the past few years, I'm sure all of you have seen numerous reports in newspapers and other online news sources about incidents across the country that involve security breaches. Since California enacted its security breach notification law in 2002, more and more states are adopting similar and more comprehensive legislation. California, in fact, has added to their original bill. As of January 2007, the National Conference of State Legislatures reported that at least 35 states have enacted legislation requiring companies or governmental agencies to disclose security breaches involving personal information. Seems like every day there is another state taking action, as we are hoping that Oregon will take now. SB 583 does more than just provide Oregonians with notice after there has been a breach of security in which computerized data that includes personal information has been compromised, and I think it's very important to note that. It requires businesses and government agencies that possess individuals' personal information to keep that information reasonably secure, both when they possess it and when they dispose of it. Furthermore, it prohibits publicly displaying Social Security numbers or printing Social Security numbers on cards required to be used to access products or services. So no longer your medical insurance card would have your Social Security number on it. Lastly, the bill allows any Oregonian to place a security freeze on a credit report, which as has been said many times before, would greatly diminish the likelihood that new accounts would be opened by an identity thief. While there is room for improvement in SB 583, the Attorney General believes it is a solid foundation to help stem the occurrence of identity theft in Oregon. We urge this committee to pass it out to the legislature, and we urge the legislature to pass the bill and give Oregonians the same protections that so many other states have already given to their citizens. And again, I will extend the same thank yous that have been said before, and I'm sure any of us would be willing to answer questions.
All right, thank you. And I'm going to open up the our witnesses for any questions that anyone may have, if you have anything at this point. If not, thank you very much. And I do want to thank y'all for being part of the work group. I know there's other members in the back of the hearing room today that also are part of the work group. And clearly, without all of your involvement, we wouldn't be where we're at today. And Laura, it's true. Not only did you help facilitate, you taught us the four different levels of either support or opposition, and our most favorite one, for those who absolutely oppose, over my dead body. So thank you very much. So we have another invited panel to give us testimony. This is from the Judicial Department. We have Judge Mary Ann Bearden, who is the presiding judge here in Lane County, and Dave Factor. And Brian looks like is also going to be joining us. Wonderful. Thank you. And as y'all are getting situated, I don't think you are in the room. I want to thank you very much for extending the facilities to us, Judge Bearden and Mr. Factor. It's wonderful to be able to have these field hearings in communities. And, of course, Harris Hall is one of the wonderful places to be able to have a hearing. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to have you here. Glad you chose to hold this hearing here, and you're welcome, of course, to come back anytime.
And I should also
travel here. We don't have to drive up the freeway quite as much.
That's true. And I also want to thank you because you made your parking spot available for the van.
We're able to find it without too much trouble. It's not easy to give directions to that spot under the ground there.
We had outstanding directions, and we drove right into it.
Terrific. Thank you. Personally, I don't intend to testify, but be willing to respond to questions the committee might have concerning practical applications of the bill as far as it applies to the Judicial Department. Judge Bearden, who is our presiding judge, will present sort of their Judicial Department's position towards the bill, and Brian DeMarco, to my left, to your right, was a participant in the work group and could respond to questions concerning the Judicial Department's activity in that work group. With that, I'd just introduce Judge Mary Ann Bearden.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Mary Ann Bearden. I am Lane County Circuit Court Judge. Thank you for the opportunity to testify about Senate Bill 583. Trial judges are on the battle lines of the fight against identity theft every day. It's an issue that we see in court every single day. We not only try the criminal cases and sentence the convicted, we hear from the victims and we see the carnage, the lives turned upside down, the enormous frustration and pain that identity theft causes. I applaud efforts, including this bill, to limit the opportunities for theft of identity and to provide new avenues of redress for those who are affected. The judicial branch has taken steps over the last few years on its own initiative to cut down on opportunities for identity theft, including working with the Department of Treasury to implement PCI security standards on credit card transactions. We also are working with the district attorney and financial institutions and insurance companies to create identifiers so that when we send restitution checks, we send them with unique identifiers instead of account numbers. Up until very recently, they would return them if the account number was not the identifier, so we've worked on that. SB 583 is a timely bill, and we're glad to see that serious efforts are being made to address this growing and changing problem. We will continue to work with the governor and the legislature and this committee to help pass the best bill possible. In that vein, we are working on some strategic, constructive, clarifying amendments, which will make the intent and scope of the bill more clear as it applies to the legitimate needs of the people of the state of Oregon that are addressed every day through the court system. The work of the courts, in conformance with the Constitution and the needs of a civilized society, must necessarily be open and transparent. There is some natural tension here, as you can see. We deal with statutes every day that require or authorize the use of personal identification information for quite legitimate purposes. Let me give you a couple of easy examples instead of the dozens that I could give you from my review of the Oregon revised statutes. My first example would be the prosecution of a person for the crime of identity theft under ORS 165-800. In order to prove the crime of identity theft, the state must necessarily prove that the defendant has used the personal identification of another. To do that, the state has to introduce exhibits to prove the crime, and those very exhibits will contain the personal identification of another person. The documents must contain this information in order for the state to prove every element of its case. Every day in this courthouse and in every other courthouse in this state, we see the introduction of exhibits with personal identification information for a variety of very critical and legitimate purposes. These legitimate needs for the public availability of personal identification information need to be clearly addressed in this bill. Let me give you another simple example. A single parent seeking to enforce a child support obligation against a deadbeat parent. Under Oregon law, the parent seeking to enforce that obligation is authorized to use the Social Security number and other personal identification information to pursue enforcement, including possibly the revocation of a driver's license or other professional license of that parent who does not pay, leave out other enforcement methods that the person would take to get the obligation fulfilled. Garnishments, and so forth. An example of a strategic amendment that we will be offering to Section 11 sub 2 would be as follows, so that 11 sub 2 would read, this section does not prevent the collection, use, or release of a Social Security number as authorized or required by state or federal law, or the use of a Social Security number for internal verification or administrative purposes, or enforcement. So that's just an example of a kind of constructive, focused amendment that we will be asking you to consider. I wanted to give you the simplest example that I could think of something that is filed every day in Oregon courts by the thousands that contains personal identification. That would be the Uniform Traffic Citation. Uniform Traffic Citation contains the name, date of birth, address, and Oregon driver's license number, the sex, and various other identifying information. On every Oregon traffic citation, I'm afraid to alert others outside of this room, there's plenty of information to then use for the fraudulent production of a fake driver's license. We also went on the sex offender registry to try to get enough information to put together a personal identity and found that that can also be done. Surely we don't mean to hamper in any way the registration of sex offenders or the filing of uniform traffic citations. I know that's not the intent, and that's why we want to make sure that when we're identifying the various sections, that we clearly define exactly what kinds of use or release will be allowed and should be allowed. As I said, I'm reluctant to publicly identify all of the statutes that require Social Security numbers or other court filings specifically, including exhibits, but not just exhibits, because I hate to alert people to opportunities. But it is important that we do coordinate to make sure that we don't have conflicting statutory provisions and expectations. We immediately identified many, many statutes that absolutely require the use of a Social Security number on judgments, on all kinds of child support, enforcement documents, and so forth. In conclusion, we have many businesses, governmental agencies, and citizens who rely on the information in court documents, exhibits, and testimony to enforce their rights. Title companies, victims of crimes, parents enforcing child support obligations, the Department of Revenue, the Department of Motor Vehicle, and law enforcement desire and are entitled by current law to receive various types of personal identification, including social security numbers, for legitimate purposes. It's not just bad people with bad motives who need or want this information. It is also good people with legitimate, even laudable motives. We are happy to continue to work on strategic amendments to help address the legitimate needs of all the citizens of the state of Oregon. Thank you. I'm open to any questions.
All right. And Brian, were you going to give us some comments, too?
Senator Prezanski, members of the committee, my name is Brian DeMarco. I'm staff counsel with the Oregon Judicial Department. Just like to say two basic things. The Chief Justice and the Oregon Judicial Department fully support Senate Bill 583. We look forward to working with the committee on some of these strategic focused amendments to alleviate some of the concerns that Judge Bearden and others have raised with some of the provisions of the bill. I would also like to extend the department's gratitude to Senator Prezanski and to Musavich for their work in this, in the work group. We'll heap accolades upon accolades today, but it's well deserved because it was a great process, and we all in the work group fully appreciate the hard work and leadership. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Sorry, Senator Ivankin.
I'm curious about this issue on the use of evidence in cases and the potentially confidential information. It seems like a very difficult thing to manage. I'm wondering, how do you get around, even if it's in statute, that certain things will be precluded, I guess, that they won't be submitted into the court, and then somehow that'll work its way into the evidentiary rules of the state. Are we going to get to a system where the judge will have to do an in-camera inspection of all documents prior to a trial starting, to ensure that those things really are kept confidential through whatever standards we adopt? Just wondering what the process would be in a courtroom.
Chair Prezanski and Senator Avakian, I don't think any litigants or trial judges want to get to that point where we would have to do that. That's what we're trying to avoid. In offering some focused and, I hope, friendly and constructive suggestions for amendments. I don't think that would be a workable world. And I also don't think that that is in harmony with the open, transparent, and public way that the public expects their business to be handled in court and that a civilized society needs.
And that also is an interesting statement that I happen to agree with, because you want your judicial process to be as open as possible to the public, like any government process would be. And the more we move towards in-camera inspections or sealed documents, and I'm even envisioning, of course, this would take federal standards, securities types litigations where you have lots of personal information that might be involved at a federal level, and then maybe eventually end up with lots of sealed documents, and then the government process becomes less public. For a very good purpose, protecting people's information, that you give up a lot in doing it by making a public process more private. And that seems like a very difficult balance to strike. But you made comments with respect to it, so I was just curious where we were headed with those types of amendments.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Avakian, our goal would be to avert that, not to go in that direction. It also would slow down proceedings tremendously the more you move in that direction. I would point out, and again, I hasten to make this too public, but I have never seen in my years on the bench, nor have any of the colleagues that I've talked to about this, and that's a lot of them, a single case of identity theft that arose out of something that happened in a courtroom or in a courthouse. So it is. We're not asking to be exempted from the provisions of this law. We're not asking for a delay in implementation. We're just asking that we be able to continue to work to make sure that the system of justice is not exempted from this, but its legitimate processes that are now in place and all of the statutory provisions we have that govern that kind of personal identification are left pretty much intact so that the public can continue to seek the remedies that they currently seek in court. What I'm looking for is a solution, and I think what the Chief Justice is looking for, is a solution that doesn't impede the court processes for the citizens of the state of Oregon.
Other questions for the panel?
And I'll put on the record, Justice Brewer and I had an opportunity to speak, I think it was earlier this week, and I know that he is also taking an active interest and will be participating when we get back into Salem and to doing some of the work group and looking at whatever amendments we may be bringing forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, we have a rule as to how we take in public testimony. We're now going to be going into that. And one of the rules is that for those who are over 100 miles from the location of our hearing, get preferential to make certain they get heard. I have a group, from my understanding, that may be here from Portland. And I'm going to try to get everyone's names correct. Brenda Eaton, Pam Ellis, and maybe Sue Trimlin. If y'all would like to come forward, since you're traveled from Portland, on my speedometer or odometer, that'd be over 100 miles. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you very much for traveling I-5 to be with us this afternoon.
Good morning. Do you want these?
Yeah, we'll get them.
I'm going to avoid a filibuster here, but I am going to take a little time because Pam isn't here to kind of speak. She's ill.
Okay. So if you would just give us your name for the record and then give us your testimony, we'd appreciate that.
Yes. My name is Brenda Eden. I'm here representing IDSafeCommunities.org. It's a newly formed organization to help all the communities within the state of Oregon really understand how to protect themselves. I teach classes on a course called ID Theft Awareness and Prevention to insurance agents and to mortgage lenders within the state of Oregon. Our course has been approved for that level of continuing education. And one of the things that we have noticed is that there is this propensity for consumers to think that government and law enforcement is responsible for righting any wrongs that happen with respect to their identities. And so we felt that just based on what I'm learning in my classrooms that people need to be proactive in helping themselves. And so with that being said, I'd like to move forward with some of the things that we have supplied the committee.
Ms. Eaton, one thing I'm going to ask you, I'm not familiar with the group. Can you give us a little bit more information as to the group itself, as to is this an industry-based group that's helping trying to educate individuals, or is this a nonprofit?
Yes, it says right here. It's a nonprofit organization.
Okay. I haven't got a chance to read everything.
Okay. So. It's on the second page.
Oh.
On the bottom of the second page.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Just for your,
okay, thank
your
you.
Reference. First of all, you know, we learned about this bill a while back, and Lou Savage was kind enough to present us the bill so that we could go over it ahead of time, so we did have some comments. But we did want to say that our organization is in full support of the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act, and we believe that it bodes well for Oregon at both the government level as well as the private sector level to work hand in hand to really look after the best interests of the citizens and the residents of every community in Oregon. I don't think any organization, any neighborhood, no one is exempt from identity theft. It occurs at all levels and also all age groups. So, and I'm hoping that, you know, whatever happens here, that we're doing a good job at educating our children on prevention as well. So I do, I have a list here, but, you know, in the interest of time, I'll just pick out those items that we would like to speak on, and then, you know, maybe the work group, which we were not a part of, would also like to have a copy of these things, because there are some some things that we have some concerns about.
Okay.
So a couple of the things that, you know, even though we're not speaking to the work group, are members of the work group still here?
There are some that are still here.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, a couple of things that came to my attention. The one that really jumped out to me first and foremost was the freeze law. And, you know, $30 to freeze and unfreeze and freeze and unfreeze and freeze and unfreeze accounts. You know, I'm not sure if the group really addressed the prohibitive nature and affordability of maybe people that are low income in order for this to happen. Can we be reckless in assuming that people that are low income also have poor credit? So we have to look at, you know, whether or not we're putting something in place, some subsidies in place to help consumers who have good credit but are low income that are, you know, also subject to being victimized by identity theft. The other thing that I was kind of curious about, you know, with respect to reporting identity theft, there's a lot of language in this bill that talks about identity theft. I'm jumping around, so if you guys bear with me, I'm just trying to pick out the things that I think are most important, you know, to our organization. You know, when you're looking at, if you go down to, it's near the bottom, the second bulleted point item where we're talking about if a consumer becomes a victim of a major breach, and we would basically qualify a major breach as something like Veterans Affairs and our Veterans Administration and Providence Health System and TJ Maxx, we've all heard, those are pretty high profile. So if I'm a victim of that, am I going to be permitted to file a identity theft affidavit with the Federal Trade Commission with law enforcement as a matter of record? And will I then be entitled to free credit freeze assistance at that point? Because there are 70 million people that were hit with the TJ Maxx thing. And so you have your high profile, your things according to this law that are going to be a matter of public record for the sake of affordability and notification. And then if I am one of those people that are in, you know, part of this pool of people, such as, you know, the organizations or companies that I just admitted, under this bill, can I go in and file a police report saying that my identity had been stolen and be allowed to receive, you know, any type of free or no free, or no, I'm sorry, it's the retainers, no fee for those freezing and unfreezing. And I'm not sure if I read correctly, if there was a time limit on how long those freezes and unfreezes and freezes and unfreezes that we're saying that are going to be no free, how is there a time stipulated on those as well, so that if I'm a victim of identity theft today from incident A and I have, say, 2 years or a year, whatever, to receive the free freeze, unfreeze, freeze, unfree benefit, what if I'm hit again? You know, I've heard stories where people have gotten three notification letters in 1 week. So I can see where, you know, this is going to create some issues. So that's all I wanted to say about the freeze thing.
Can you respond, and since you're going to go through some different perspectives, I'll try to give you some clarity since we'd like to have your participation in as to other areas. The cost of the freeze, one of the things that we talked about is that clearly that you do have three major reporting agencies, and there would be that fee if you were voluntarily wanting to do the freeze. So there would be the cost for that, but then what some of the people in the work group talked about is that if someone wanted to do a thaw or temporary lifting of that to establish credit for a new account, that they more than likely would do one or two things. They would find out from the individual retail or whoever has will need to have access what service they use to have it thawed through them, or to open up the opportunity to say, I will unfreeze only one of these three credit reporting companies so you can go through them. Regarding the length of time that these freezes or thaws would be in place, that was left open in the sense of the consumer would be able to ask for a specific length of time. Clearly what we heard from the retailers or other merchant type of people that are going to be establishing credit is that there is a
time lapse that they would need to be able to process those type of requests. So one of the things we're attempting to do is leave it more open-ended for the consumer to be able to determine whatever would be a length, as compared to having the reporting agency say, once you thaw it, it's going to stay open for some length of time. So give more flexibility for the consumer. So, and then regarding the length of time for freezes, that was not fully discussed, and that's probably one of the things that we will hit on. I don't remember that being actually said, what the duration of that time would be for a free freeze, but context that I heard from one of the representatives was that it was not limited. But I think clarification would be great.
All right. Since Senator Brzezinski, you were on that committee. Also, again, the question about the major breaches, could you address that? If I'm a victim of, say, I get the notification in the mail, that which happened to me through my credit union, I said, why did I get a new debit card? They said, well, because you had probably used at some point in the last year, you probably frequented Marshall's or TJ Maxx, which I have. So under this, those type of breaches where I didn't personally have something happen to me or where it was indirect through a third party, am I going to be entitled to that no-fee freeze, freezing and unfreezing and freezing and unfreezing when I want to have access or limit access to my information now as a personal safety precaution?
Yeah, the way it was explained to us during the work group from the individual who was representing one of the credit reporting agencies is basically if someone claims that they have been a victim of identity theft, they will get that service for no cost.
Right, no matter what the source. No matter the source. When I'm saying a major company, it could be a company back east, out of our state boundaries.
Right. That's
so,
right.
Okay, yeah, so it's very broad for a reason that for protection purposes, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. I appreciate your patience with me. We spent a lot of time on this, by the way.
Well, thank you very much.
There was something that jumped out at me just because I have 20-some-odd years of a technical background. And one of the things that I noticed here that it said in the bill that technical modifications of a consumer's official information, including name and street abbreviations, complete spellings, or transposition of numbers or letters. These people would not have to comply with notification. My concern, and I'm not sure if any of you individual on the committee here understand, it was in the no notification required, I think it's the section that talks about, it's a pretty important one just because of what I know about technology.
Brenda, what I'm going to ask you to do, if you have the sections that you're referring to that are in the bill, if you could highlight or ID those for us. One of the things I do, looking at the time, we do have some other people that have come in.
All right.
What we can do is we can post them, and then we'll ask you to work with us outside of the hearing process to help clarify this.
Okay. Well, just this last thing for me then.
Okay.
It's called technical modifications, and this relates to section, I think it was, I don't know what page it was on here. Did you find it, section 3, technical modifications?
Yes.
Line 2, page. Did you find it?
Page 7, line 2. Yep.
Right. Okay, well, knowing what I know about synthetic identities, does anybody here on the committee understand what synthetic identities mean?
I don't.
Okay, well, let me explain as succinctly as I can. That means if your name is, say, let me pick out a name here. Anna Braun.
Easy, are they?
Let's just say, Anna, that your last name is really Bronski, and someone creates an identity very similar to yours, and from what I understand, credit bureaus give some level of tolerance when you fill out an application to, you know, have some level of maybe there's transposition in the handwriting or something that looked like a T, but it was really a whatever. So what happens is when they go in and truncate that information in a computer system, say your name was Anna Bronski, could be Anne Braun. So if Anne Braun is a fake identity, then they can't find Anna Braun, but because you, this other person, your name is really Anna Bronski, right? it's close enough to be your identity now. So that's why I was concerned that, you know, by allowing no notification under this modification, which is truncating of information, basically is what I'm interpreting that to mean, that that could open up, and if you guys want to do a Google search on synthetic identities, you'll find that they're saying that credit monitoring is almost worthless compared to the damage that can be done with synthetic identities, and people assuming your name and living under, and you're assuming their credit, and these people may not even exist. So I would encourage you to do a little. It's very interesting.
Okay. Thank you.
Hello, Senator Przanski, Council. I'm very excited about this bill, and I'm a volunteer with IDCF Communities. I'm a concerned citizen. Sue Trimlin. Did I say my name? Sorry. Pardon me? Yes, Sue Trimlin. I'm sorry. So one of my concerns was just the idea of, as far as a, constituting a breach, is just the safety of public records, because it's my understanding that if identities are and Social Securities are registered in those, that information could be breached as far as someone going in and requesting information for fraudulent purposes. So that was just one of my concerns, if that might be part of this bill, as far as you know, making certain information available to, still to the public, if that was a consideration. And so I guess that's just a concern I wanted to voice. Also, it's just looking at the feasibility of how this will be enforced. Are there provisions for understanding, as far as the investigations go, is there a cost concern there, as far as do we know how much it will cost to do investigations, or how that's going to be funded? How do you qualify who's actually doing the investigation, and
just that whole clarification, in the sense of investigation you're talking about, like for a filing of a police report and having...
Well, as far as if there is a company breach, if there is a breach of information, that investigation, the costs involved, and is there provisions set up for that? Because my understanding is it is, when the government does investigations, it's quite expensive, as far as $10,000 to $20,000 per case, and so I was wondering if that was factored in, so there really is a way that this would be implemented with the funding.
Okay.
May I? Are you concerned? I'm trying to figure out what your concern is. Are you concerned that the government should be investigating, but there won't be adequate resources to do a good investigation? Or are you concerned that taxpayer dollars would be used to investigate something that the private entity that lost the data should be paying for?
Well, I guess it says an investigation will be conducted, so I guess some clarity on that, where the funding was coming from. Or am I answering that?
Well, because if there's not funding, adequate resources available, I think is what Sue's trying to allude to. If there's not adequate funding available, what's the efficacy of having an investigative group or body of people investigating something if there's no money to do it? The other concern with those kinds of things would be the delay in having that as resources are looked for, you know, or secured for these investigations. The effect that it has on the consumer in the time delay, you know, with notifications and taking action. And
right.
I think that's what she was talking about in terms of
what we'll do. We'll take the rest of your concerns and we'll get someone else up maybe that can answer some of the questions that have come up.
Great. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you.
Leave.
I would like to say to both of you, thank you very much for coming down and providing this very important testimony. It's great to know that there's an organization focused on prevention, and particularly, as you say it here in your literature, preventing preventable. Mm-hmm. I'd also like to get the correct last name spelling of Ms. Eaton's?
E-A-D-E-N.
E-A-D-E-N. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. If you'd like a phone number, I have a card I can give you later.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you. And what I'm going to do is call up a number of individuals that are wanting to give testimony. We'll just go ahead and put four people up here. That will save a little bit of time in getting people coming and going. Don Grant, Diana Roth, Rick Bennett, and it looks like maybe Sue Whitaker.
Mm-hmm.
State your name first and then go ahead and give us your testimony. We'd love to hear it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Donald Grant. I live at 2457 John Main Street in Eugene. I've been a resident in Oregon for about 3 years now. I'm very much in support of the bill to freeze credit reports. I'm going to stumble around quite a bit because much that's been said while I've sat and listened to testimony really strikes a chord, and I noticed some of it struck a chord with the committee. In particular, synthetic identity. I've only recently, I had never heard that term, but I've only recently discovered how many ways my identity can be tracked with totally misinformation. The information submitted on a credit report or an application comes back tied to me, but they had all wrong information. Conversely, I pay to get a credit report and may struggle for weeks and months to get my own credit report so that I can work on trying to straighten out these kinds of errors that I've just experienced having a credit report drawn on me. The issue of freeze and the cost of the freeze is an interesting one in that at next month I'll be 70. I live below my means. I have ample means to live very comfortably. I have perfect credit for 50 years. However, two of the credit bureaus report I have no credit history and no credit score. Well, one of the comments recently made was would be quite convenient for me is I could freeze all three of my credit reports. It would prevent the 23 years of misinformation that has gone into becoming my credit history. And since only one of the three credit bureaus actually reasonably represents my credit, I could just unfreeze that one from time to time when I needed credit. And that would at least guide my creditors to the credit bureau that actually somewhat accurately portrays who I am. I'm struck by the notion that the Eugene Police Department alone takes an average of 15 reports a day on these issues. The judge's testimony was quite fascinating in that all of the information that I've read, and I've read everything I could lay my hands on for the last 14 years where I've tried to unravel my own problems, I can shred everything that comes in my mailbox, I can shred all my personal papers, but I can't block the kinds of information that might inadvertently get into the court system or my driver's license, vehicle registrations, and other public information. Right? So, as I've listened to the testimony again, I'm struck by the fact that perhaps since it's completely out of the realm reports a day on these issues. The judge's testimony was quite fascinating in that all of the information that I've read, and I've read everything I could lay my hands on for the last 14 years where I've tried to unravel my own problems, I can shred everything that comes in my mailbox, I can shred all my personal papers, but I can't block the kinds of information that might inadvertently get into the court system or my driver's license, vehicle registrations, and other public information. So, as I've listened to the testimony again, I'm struck by the fact that perhaps since it's completely out of the realm today that we're ever going to protect our identity, our keep it private, I should say, then the next best thing is to protect it in a fashion where the thief or the person with bad motives can't use it. So the freeze seems to accomplish that in a fairly large measure. It's my impression that most, if not all, of my problems could have been prevented if I had been able to freeze it. My problems start before identity theft was even identity theft. But my problem today is that I cannot get a cooperative effort with my creditors, who I have good and legitimate credit with. I can't direct them to report to each credit bureau. You know, they decide who they're going to report to. I cannot get the credit bureaus to report good credit long-term. For example, I'm 46 years a member of the Los Angeles Farmers Credit Union. One of the three credit bureaus reports that. The other two used to. For whatever reason, they don't anymore. So, 46 years of stable, responsible conduct and good credit history doesn't exist with two of the credit bureaus. And where do you go for help? I mean, it becomes extremely lonely and very frustrating because you cannot force anybody to help you. And you have no. Here I am.
Mr. Grant, thank you for your testimony, and it sounds like maybe a portion of this bill will help you in some ways for the future. There, you know, and I'm not really sure, except for maybe checking with the Department of Justice, they may be able to give you some other guidance that you may not have already received as to other protective means or things you can go back to try to help correct these other wrongs.
Thank you for those comments, Senator Poronski. The other things that have come into play in very recent years are some of the consumer advocacy groups, Consumer Union in particular, and I've just recently become aware of Osprey. These people are doing some very hard, very good work. They're putting out information that has been terribly secret. You know, the fact that you don't know, you think you pay your bills and that is good enough. But if you've got various kinds of different credit, if you have too much credit, you have too little credit, you simply have no way of determining how to meet the insurance company's requirement or the lender's requirement, or you know, it just goes out into infinity. And finally, some of that stuff is coming to light of day, and that's hopefully finding its way to your committee. And anyway, thank you very much,
Mr. Grant. Again, thank you, Diana. Is it Roth? Okay, if you take the microphone and get it a little closer to you, and give us your name and then your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Pazanski and members of the committee. My name is Diana Roth, and I live on 1750 Mistletoe Street in Eugene, and I've been here for 9 years now. More than 10 years ago, I discovered that my name and Social Security number had been used fraudulently to obtain credit. Some of these accounts had gone into collections, including a federal loan. The person who stole my identity lived in a state where I had never lived. Following the credit bureau's instructions, I filed affidavits and contacted the appropriate local and federal authorities, including the Social Security Administration. No one would help me. So for years, I attempted to correct the matter and restore my credit, only to find the negative information back on my credit report within several months. Fraud alerts were ignored. Countless letters and phone calls were made to credit bureaus, loan administrators, and collection agencies. Affidavits were completed and sent along with my marriage license, driver's license, and Social Security card. I had to prove that I was not the person who obtained the credit or loan. Applying for mortgages has never been easy. I've had to write letters to lenders explaining that the negative information did not belong to me. The negative information did not help my credit score. It had an impact on my credit score, and those help to determine the interest rate that you receive on a mortgage, loan, or any major purchase, such as a car. In addition, every credit inquiry goes into the calculation of your credit score. A approximately 15 months ago, my credit history had spiraled out of control. Upon reviewing my report, I discovered medical bills that were not mine, that were in collections, and they totaled in excess of $2,000. There were credit card accounts not opened by me, credit inquiries that were not initiated by me, and addresses and names that were not mine. My last name fell under the other names used, and my current address was listed as somewhere I have never lived. I was devastated because my identity was gone. Affidavits were again filed, including a federal that was required, and along with my driver's license information and Social Security information. All of this, including copies of the damaged credit reports, were filed with the local police, and a report has also been filed in the state where the thief lives. During the restoration of my credit, when a negative item was removed from one report, it would appear on another. In spite of the fraud alert, new credit inquiries appeared, and this went back and forth for months. The amount of stress on me and my family has been insurmountable. I've been afraid to even apply for credit for fear of embarrassment. And a great deal of time has been spent by me and others to restore my credit, hopefully for good this time. A 7-year fraud alert has been placed on my credit report, but they're not obligated to follow the alert. If a thief were to apply for credit again using my name and Social Security number without a freeze on my credit, there is nothing to stop a creditor from granting credit. They're not obligated to follow this fraud alert. Negative information on my credit report will cause problems when potential employers review my credit to see if I would be a reliable employee. I've worked very hard to achieve and maintain a good credit history, and a security freeze is the only tool that will allow me to be in control of who is able to view my personal credit history and information. Otherwise, the thief can and will continue to use and destroy my credit. And thank you all for your time.
Thank you for coming forward, both of you sharing your stories.
Her story is just nearly identical to mine, and it's over and over, and I think she and I would both say that we're here. The damage has been done to us.
Right.
We would like to get our lives back. But there's so many other people that can be prevented this misery that you just have to speak.
Yeah, thank you very much. Mr. Bennett, thank you for joining us. One of the other individuals that was part of our work group.
Thank you, Chairman Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I've provided you with a letter of support as well as some background material related to breach notification and security freeze, as well as a brochure that AARP developed in conjunction with the Federal Trade Commission, providing information to individuals as how they might better protect themselves against identity theft. With the interest in time, I'll try to be very brief. Just a couple of points I'd like to make. AARP obviously is very interested in this issue. As an age group, the 50-plus age group is disproportionately affected when we talk about identity theft crimes. There's many reasons for this, not the least of which is just the fact that as we age, most of us acquire additional assets, and we acquire a longer financial history, and that provides more access points for identity thieves to try and acquire our information. With that in mind, it's of no surprise that when we survey our members and the general public, the concerns related to identity theft are overwhelmingly strong, always 90% or better as far as the issue, and just as strong in their support for strengthening state laws and regulations in this regard. And with that in mind, I was very pleased to be invited to participate in the work group. As already noted, we put in a lot of time and effort with the group and its many different perspectives on this issue. It's not always an easy discussion. As noted, the ranking of issues and our positions and so forth got down to over my dead body. And I, on the record, I'd just like to state that at no time did I welcome or want the opportunity to step over Jim Marquis's body.
Jim is in the back.
One thing, I'm not sure if it's been mentioned today, but you did make mention of it at the press event yesterday, and that was, I think, the overwhelming consensus of the work group that both the public and private sectors be covered by this legislation, and we think that's a very good idea. Again, with any product that comes out of a work group that's put in as much time and effort on this with such diverse perspectives on an issue and so forth, I think I would probably also echo the caution that Jim Markey made mention of as well, and that is this is a very fragile product, and when you start making changes, it could very easily come unraveled. And I believe this is a very good product. I think this is a strong step forward for the state of Oregon and Oregon consumers. And I'm very pleased to be before you today and to offer AARP support of Senate Bill 583. And then the one thing, other thing that I would duplicate is just to thank the DCBS staff for their work, and certainly the work of all the members on the work group. And certainly thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your work on this as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming forward. And let's see, our next panel is going to be, I believe it's Willard Robson and Peg Kerr and Carl, is it Polimo? I'm not sure about that.
Pullman, maybe.
Maybe Pullman.
Or Peebleman.
I can't tell if it's a B or an H, and I apologize. Hello, Peg.
Hiya.
I'll give you an introduction. Peg Kerr was one of my legislative assistants in my first session, if I remember correctly. Second, number two. See, my memory fades me. Thank
but
you.
You began working on this then, I can tell you that.
Well, thank you very much.
I remember opening the letters.
Peg, why don't you start off?
Okay. My name is Peg Kerr. I live in Eugene. And this timing of this hearing is quite a coincidence, because yesterday my husband received a letter from a charter school he did contract work with, saying that a laptop containing his social security number and other information had been stolen 10 days previously. So it took roughly 10 days for the letter to get to him, although there was a phone call previously. And because this has just happened, I have my perspective is from the person who doesn't know whether they're going to be affected by identity theft I had a couple questions. One is that a lot of the bill is directed, which I support, by the way, is directed at impact of information on credit. I don't know whether you discussed or how you addressed impact on other social security issues from a stolen social security number. And I don't know if there are other remedies that could have been put in the bill just addressing how will this affect my social security identity. So that's an issue. Because his happened, the breach for him happened through a public charter school and a laptop, it raised questions of, I hope in the bill, public body as defined by ORS 174-109, I hope that will cover public schools, public charter schools, but also schools these days, especially with security concerns with kids. I don't know whether you know that they routinely collect driver's license and car insurance information from any volunteer who might be driving a kid. So parents who, this is not employment information, it's, and you know, it sits on the desk of the school secretary sort of until someone needs it. I hope that the definitions in here would cover identity of volunteers, identity information of volunteers at schools. I would love to see a phrase in this bill which said public bodies should not keep sensitive information on laptops, because just the fact that there's now something called a laptop breach would indicate to me that that's, everybody knows now, that's the least secure way of storing information. My other questions are around the dealing with credit bureaus. I believe that I've been told by banks that if you frequently check your credit record, that
also can boost your, or not boost, can depress your credit rating. I don't think someone who's been a victim of identity theft should have to suffer that. If they follow what this letter from the school would tell me to do, which is every four times a year, check your credit rating. Well, that begins to affect my credit rating. So I don't think they should be penalized. A definition question. I don't know whether the freeze that your bill talks about is the same as an alert, a fraud alert, which is what the language is now, and the language that this letter from the school uses. My final concerns are around what you're requiring from the school in this case, who put this information on a laptop. I think maybe you're being a little bit too easy on someone who has collected this information and then lost it. I would like to see in the bill a mandate that the institution or the agency that collected, in this case, probably hundreds of names that then were lost, that they have to not only notify those people of a breach, but provide them information about the police report, possibly a case number, because I can imagine my husband calling the credit bureau, and they, if this law went into effect, and they say, well, have you filed a police report? He would have to say, no, I haven't. The school has. But he would have no documentation. He would have no way of saying, yes, a police report's been filed. Yes, my name is in that police report, and this is the number. He'd have no proof. But I also don't believe it should be his job to go to the police and file a report. The other thing that I would like to see is, in this case, if the school knew that there had been attempted use of the information on the laptop, I think they should have to notify the other people whose information they collected. If their credit begins to show signs of damage, I would like my husband to be notified. Thank you for coming to Eugene.
Thank you.
My name is Willard C. Robinson. I'm a resident of Eugene, Oregon. In fact, I live a block and a half from where I was born. I sent a letter to all of the representatives of the state of Oregon and all of the senators and the governor in regard to this very thing that you've covered. You've done a magnificent job. I want to thank you very much. The reason I sent the letter is my wife and I are both in our 80s, and we feel it's time we get a little protection as far as freezing our credit. You may read the letter yourself when you have time to look it up. Thanks again. You've covered all the questions I had.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming down and sharing your parts. And just one thing, there is a difference between the alert and a freeze. The alert is basically puts the person who may be extending credit to you on alert that there could be a problem with that account. The freeze is something that you would actually lock out anyone being at having access to your account without your approval. So it's much more stringent and more protective. All right, our last panel that I have, at least in the people that are listed here, we have Paul Walker, Dave Fedanke, and I'm going to ask again, it's Carl Peopleman, maybe. I'm just going to see if Carl's here or not. I didn't see him come up on the last call. So, then, while these two gentlemen are coming forward, is there anyone else here that didn't sign up that wanted to give testimony today? Not seeing anyone raise their hand, then this will be our last panel. And Mr. Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me this opportunity, members of the committee. My name is Paul Walker. I live in the River Road area, and I'm here speaking as a victim of identity theft, both me and my wife. Over the holidays, our home was broken into, and everything of any value was stolen from us, including our identities. Our computers went through all our files and stole my wife's naturalization papers, stole our computers, my passport, her passport. Everything was gone. So I want to thank all of you for all the work you've done on Senate Bill 583, excuse me, and I really appreciate it. I think it's high time it was done. A couple of things I wanted to go over. I think we still need some more interagency law enforcement cooperation in the area of identity theft and these so-called property crimes to help corral these thieves. In my review and investigation of what I can do to protect ourselves, I've discovered that most local law enforcement agencies are operating in many cases independently and not receiving the interagency support I think is necessary to track these criminals down and follow through on stopping this kind of thing. So it would be good to address that component also. Another suggestion I would have for preventing identity theft is thumbprint identification. When a person even goes into a store to use a credit card, these thieves immediately started using stolen credit cards, going to businesses in the community. And even though we had CID written on some of our credit cards, they simply slide the card through the little machine. And these thieves are savvy. They do it for a living, and they know which businesses to go to and which businesses not to go to get away with it.
Mr. Walker, CIE is?
A CID.
CID, okay. Just, gotcha.
And so the cashier, whoever is running the card, should look at the person's identification.
Right.
That's written on the card. They still don't ask me when I go in and use my credit cards for that. So there needs to be more training and some corporate responsibility in this regard too. My feeling is that many of these corporations simply take the hit for these costs of these thefts from them and then pass the expense on to the consumers. I would like to see them be a little more proactive in pursuing these criminals and assisting law enforcement and the judicial system in stopping this problem. We've taken a tremendous financial hit. And as the gentleman before me said, you know, you work many, many years to build up a certain amount of assets. And these people come in and wipe you out in a matter of a couple of days. They stole my vehicle and used my vehicle to haul all of our goods away from the house. And we're still dealing with the identity theft component. The other thing is, my feeling is strongly that I should be able to go to these businesses and request all of the information on the transactions that the fraudulent transactions that occurred. It's my identity that was used, my credit card that was used, and I think it's outrageous for some of these corporations to require a subpoena for me to get my own information from them. That's outrageous. And some of the companies are much more cooperative than others, and I have a list. I'd like to mention a couple that are not cooperative, and one of them is Cricket, and the other one is Microsoft. They just stonewall, basically, and I feel they pass the expense on to the consumers. The other thing is the ease of opening accounts with fraudulent identities. One of the people was arrested in a high-speed chase and it was discovered that he had opened an account using my credit card from jail to set up a collect call account so he could call his cohorts and let them know what had happened. So that's another thing that I believe could be addressed. The other thing that would be an advantage to the consumer who's been a victim of this is the freeze automatically activating a fraud alert, long-term fraud alert with the credit agencies. Right now, to activate a long-term fraud alert, you have to write to each one of the agencies separately in their format and tell them you want the 3-year fraud alert on your account. To someone who's dealing with so many components of this crime and trying to put their lives back together, it's a lot to ask. Some of the agencies are a little bit more user-friendly than others. TransUnion is one of the better ones. But the other two, it's difficult to speak to anyone when you call them and to figure out what their format is for getting a fraud alert on your identity. I don't know if I mentioned the thumbprint ID or not. I think that's an important thing, too, if we could move on with technology and get that done. So I've pretty much covered all of the points I think I wanted to. Oh, the other one more thing, though, is that when these people are caught, I think there's a significant methamphetamine component to these crimes. The people that burgled our house and used our identities were methamphetamine addicts, I'm sure. We found used needles out in the orchard next door where they had posted their lookout while they were robbing us. And these people need to be incarcerated. Posted their lookout while they were robbing us. And these people need to be incarcerated at least long enough to dry out, because if they're just incarcerated and then turned loose the next day through the matrix system, they're right back out there using meth and committing more crimes. And this is something that's been told to me both by law enforcement officers and by the DAs. I've talked to both, and that's something that needs to be addressed too. We need to incarcerate these people at least long enough for them to get their wits about them, because methamphetamine makes them completely irrational and unapproachable. So thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Walker.
And thank you for all the good work you've done too. I appreciate it.
Mr. Fidanke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, also appearing in support of Senate Bill 583 this afternoon, along with everyone else. The ACLU has a number of reforms that we have been supporting around the country to try to protect people's privacy and prevent identity theft. Most of those things are in this legislation, and we applaud you for moving it forward. In particular, allowing consumers to put the freeze on their credit report, limiting the use, printing, and posting of social security numbers, requiring notification to consumers in the event of security breaches, and requiring data aggregators to develop and implement adequate information security programs and substantive requirements for such security programs. One of our recommendations, which is not in this legislation, Mr. Chair, I know was consciously left out in the interest of compromise, and that would be to create a private cause of action for victims of identity theft and security breaches when businesses have not taken reasonable security measures. We understand that the choice has been made to give broad enforcement power to enforce the provisions of this bill to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We understand that they will be putting together rules to implement this bill. One area of the bill where we believe that is going to be critical is in Section 3, Subsection 7 of the bill, which is the escape hatch for notification. notwithstanding subsection 1, notification is not required after an appropriate investigation or after consultation with relevant federal, state, or local agencies responsible for law enforcement. The person reasonably believes that the breach has not been and will not likely result in harm to the individuals whose personal information has been acquired and accessed. One of the previous witnesses focused on, well, what's the definition of an appropriate investigation? And how does one determine if a business has reasonably determined that the breach will not result in damage to the persons affected? We'll be looking to the Department of Consumer and Business Services to put flesh on those bones. But we hope that in the future, as you watch the implementation of this legislation, you will remember the possibility of creating a private right of action if, in fact, these do not prove to be adequate safeguards for individuals. And finally, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to also underscore something else that's been mentioned this afternoon, which is the government is part of the problem. And it's not just the federal VA and losing their laptop that is the problem, but other actions by government, not the least of which is the required federal implementation of the Real ID Act, which has a number of problems that will make it much more likely for Americans to be subjected to identity theft in the future if that legislation is implemented in its current form. And I'll give you just one example. Because the Real ID Act would require individuals, in order to renew their driver's license or get a new driver's license, to show original Social Security cards or embossed copies of a birth certificate or an original passport to prove that individual's identity. But just showing those documents is not all that will happen under Real ID. Motor vehicle employees will be required to scan those documents, which will then become part of the DMV record that will not only be accessible to DMV employees in the state where you get a license, but to DMV employees in every DMV office around the country. Now, I would like to think that all Oregon DMV employees are noble and upstanding individuals. But the reality is that that kind of record being available to thousands of government employees around the country will itself become a target for identity theft and will become a treasure trove for identity thieves if they can get access to it. So we encourage members of this committee to be watching very carefully as legislation moves through this session of the legislature that may create new databases or other provisions in Oregon law. We're counting on all of you to be watchdogs to prevent identity theft through government agencies here in Oregon. Thank you all.
Thank you, and thank you for giving us testimony not only on the bill that's before us, the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act, but also the heads up for the Real ID Act. I will just mention to you, yes, but there's a lot of conversation that took place on the private cause of action. We did decide through the consensus negotiations, etc., over my dead body, etc., approach, decided not to do that, but there is still common law that's available to any individual to be able to bring a suit, but not as per se a private right cause of action. So, committee, any questions for either of the two gentlemen before us? Well, thank you very much, both of you. And I'd like to again thank everyone that has come to attend today. It's been our pleasure to be here in Eugene. And thank you for being part of the process. And if there's no other business for us, Ms. Brown,
well, thank you.
The committee will be adjourned, and we will be scheduled to meet on Monday at 3 o'clock. And I do understand there may be a couple of things happening that may cause some adjustments based on some other...
who's meeting at 6?
Yeah. Okay.
Senate Revenue's meeting at 6.
Okay. That's why I wasn't sure about when that's happening. So we'll be adjourned until our regular time, at least at this point, on Monday. Thank you.
Good hearing.